Caught Offside with Andrew Gundling and J.J. Devaney.
Lima was blocked. You get a second chance. It's going to bounce off the run. It's time for Jordan Morris. They all count the same, and that one ties the game. Oh, yes. Caught Offside from the Upper West Side of Manhattan, Andrew Gundling and J.J. Devaney. And if you didn't think we'd be doing an emergency podcast after a USA-Uruguay friendly, you'd be wrong. What's up, brother?
Hey, how are you, man?
It was a goal befitting of the field on which it was played.
You always know when a commentator says they all count the same.
Yeah. Oh,
that there may have been a drop in quality on that goal.
1-1 is your final. The U.S. and Uruguay tonight in St. Louis at Busch Stadium. We are here doing an emergency podcast. People might be stunned by that. We do a lot of these after USA games, but not often after friendlies such as this one.
Is this an emergency podcast, or is it more just a podcast?
All right, that's fair. I mean, look, it's after 10 o'clock at night.
That usually means emergency for us.
Yeah. So we will talk, of course. This is really a podcast. We'll do a lot of our usual things. We have a big what to watch for. We've got red cards, men of the match, a mailbag. So we'll get into a lot of other things as well. But this is kind of a podcast devoted to the last few days of men's soccer here in the United States.
We've got a lot of other stuff to get into. There's a lot of other stuff.
But it's mainly that.
But I have a lot of other stuff.
No, this is a U.S. podcast.
But I have other stuff lined up.
But we have to.
But there's other stuff.
Stay tuned. But mainly because, JJ, it's something that you said to me before we started recording tonight when we were kind of just like settling in here, taking out our food, getting ready to watch the game. And you were saying that in the wake of the Mexico game, on the heels of the previous Mexico game, it felt like we had kind of hit sort of, what's the word I'm looking for? Like a little minor like eruption in the psyche of the American soccer fan, which is already in a very fragile, delicate place. And I think what happened Friday night in MetLife Stadium really rattled some people.
If this was an EKG chart from a medical center, it showed a little spike.
Yeah.
And that spike was in the negative after what happened in New Jersey the other night.
Yeah, so we'll talk about both. Look, I'll be honest. We'll start with what's most fresh in our minds, and that, of course, is the 90 minutes that we just witnessed between the U.S. and Uruguay. Stu Holden said this on the broadcast, and I'm kind of paraphrasing him, but it's so, so true. He really nailed it when he said it. This one felt like a friendly. We make fun sometimes of when the U.S. and Mexico play in friendlies because, like, it just doesn't feel right. We play them so much in games of actual consequence that when we play them in a game of no consequence, it's kind of like, what are we doing this for? But having said that, that game Friday night did not feel like a friendly. This one really did.
Everything in the run-up to that game on Friday night felt like a friendly until that ball was kicked and the stadium was full. And you were under no illusions. Neither of the teams like each other, and both were going out to prove a point. And both teams also,
what really helped it was they both played fairly representative squads. I know there were a few players here and there missing.
But a lot of that was injury.
Yeah.
It wasn't through experimentation.
But I mean, Mexico, like Tecatito back in the fold. Chicharito, Lozano coming on as a sub, Hector Herrera back. Like guys who didn't even play
Guardado
in the Gold Cup.
Yeah. No, I agree with you. But this game tonight was absolutely in the category of September friendly. I mean, it felt like we played the qualifier and now we've got this friendly to fulfill and here we go. And it had that feeling all the way through. The crowd, I mean, I don't know how many was there, looked in the region of 20,000. Busch Stadium didn't seem full. The American Outlaws did their best to make noise, but it sounded cavernous and it seemed to fly off into the ether. Both sides, first of all, Uruguay playing with not a huge amount of urgency in terms of pressing or anything like that. Also playing a fairly new formation for them in playing 4-3-3. They looked a little bit off. We looked a little bit off. And therefore you got this kind of very much a friendly game, but with some talking points sprinkled in.
Yeah, look, the U.S. were definitely better than what we saw Friday night. Now, they could almost only be better than what we saw Friday night. But, if you look at the statistics, the U.S. were pretty dominant in possession. I think had the edge in both shots and shots on target. Now, having said that, they could have easily lost this game. The goal that was scored for the U.S. can only be described as being a total fluke. Now, that's not to say that they weren't necessarily deserving of at least getting one in this game. Christian Roldan had a good attempt on net early on. I was glad that Jordan Morris was the one who scored the goal, because even before that, he was probably going to be my man of the match. I thought he put in a good performance. There were, you know, like they've talked about, and we've talked about, his move out to the left wing with Seattle has really kind of bore out as a good thing for him. And then he was played in that same position tonight for Greg Berhalter, and I thought he was really good. In the first half, most of the action for the U.S. in the attacking end of the field came down his side. I thought that was a really good performance from him.
Yeah, and when it wasn't him, there was that chance in the 38th minute. Tim Ream plays a long ball out, which Sargent holds up. Which I think, if there's a passage of play that I would like to take to Greg Berhalter, and show him, it will be that one.
It's all those G's you stumbled through.
Once you get through the G's,
the field of G's,
then you hit Berhalter, you're in a mess. But anyway, there was a ball over the top that Sargent controlled, held up, and rolled for Dest, Sergiño Dest, who pulled a save, who made the keeper go full stretch. So that was a moment. But again, it was bitty. There was bits and pieces. We gave the ball away a lot. Uruguay gave away the ball a lot too. It was just a friendly. Really.
Yeah. You know, other moments too, like this conversation, Zach Steffen, for all intents and purposes, he's the U.S. number one. I think we're all moving forward under that assumption. But you keep hearing how Brad Guzan wants to remain a part of the fold, that he's not going to go quietly. So then you see things like him kind of spilling one. Maybe it took a bit of a short hop in front of him, but
should have covered it, should have smothered it.
It's still a veteran keeper that you kind of expect better than, and Tim Ream was there to bail him out. We should talk about the goal that Uruguay scored, not just the one that Jordan Morris scored on the fluky deflection. LAFC, I mean, I know there are obviously LAFC / U.S. men's national team fans, but LAFC fans had to be seeing that from Brian Rodriguez and thinking, yes, this is
what we want. This is what we want to see regularly. I think the crucial thing from a U.S. perspective on this is that we're on the attack. Suddenly we lose the ball, and it's like one pass and the whole of the field is opened up. Our backline is exposed. The midfield's been completely vacated, and we can't get close to the breaking Uruguay players. The ball slipped out to Rodriguez. 1v1 with Aaron Long. It was ugly. He turned him inside out and then leathered one past Guzan at the left-hand side post. Yes, is that Guzan's near post, but I don't think he's stopping that one way or the other. It was a worrying kind of goal because it was similar to the goal we conceded, I believe the third goal we conceded against Mexico, where again they broke, and we all of a sudden, within one pass, Mexico were bearing down on, again, Aaron Long, and I think it was Miles Robinson as well in that move, and it ends up in the back of the net. It's got to be harder than that if we're going to play these top-level teams. We can't make it that easy.
Yeah, honestly, I don't have too much else to say specifically about the Uruguay game. You know, I guess a couple positives here and there. It was nice to see Paxton Pomykal playing, Sergiño Dest playing again, Miles Robinson playing. You know, more young players, this infusion of youth, it's continuing. It's like this wave that just keeps coming of young players that are getting their chances. There's going to be some rough moments, although I thought in limited action, Paxton Pomykal came in and was very positive in that one move on the near side when he, you know, you're kind of waiting for him to make that pass, and instead he's just kind of like, screw it, I'm going to just take this myself. You know, eventually gets smashed away by Coates, but you just like to see that sort of initiative from a young player, like one of his first touches as a member of the U.S. men's national team, and he's going for it. So you like that kind of confidence in a young player.
And it was fair to say that while it wasn't Uruguay's strongest side, it did have guys of experience.
I mean,
Bentancur, Jimenez, Coates in the side. You know, there was the remnants of their first 11 at least, and it wasn't a completely naive team that they played against. Okay, it was in a new formation for them, but all the same, look, it was everything that we thought it would be, particularly coming after the intensity of Friday night's game.
Yeah. So let's go back now to Friday night's game, because that is still kind of on the forefront of our minds collectively as U.S. soccer fans. It was bad. It was ugly. And I think whatever negative feelings we were still feeling from the Gold Cup final, it did nothing to suppress those feelings. If anything, it only further solidified whatever the gap is that we believe exists between us and Mexico. I came away Friday night feeling that gap had even widened some, because, you know, like, I guess we should have already thought that in the Gold Cup when we lost to Mexico and they're playing a B-side. and the U.S. have 18 players out there. Now Mexico come back with their, for like we said, for the most part, A squad guys. And, you know, it very much felt that way. We are not, I don't know, we're not close to them right now. And people tell us all the time, and you tell me all the time, don't read too much into friendlies. Don't read too much into friendlies.
Yeah.
And sometimes you're right. There is truth in that. But other times I hear that and I kind of think, well, then when am I supposed to make judgments about the U.S.? Because here's the thing that, like, yourself, other, you know, other guys from Europe or South America, like, you know, you guys have a cycle before a World Cup with European championships and qualifying for European championships that matter.
Yeah.
Where you're allowed to make judgments. South America, Copa America, things like that, qualifying for all that, and a qualifying cycle for the South American for CONMEBOL World Cup qualifying that feels like it's endless.
Right.
CONCACAF, we don't have that. Like our opportunities to try to take thoughts and past judgments on this team, they're just more limited because, like, our games of real consequence are not to the same level of those in South America and Europe. So we have to take certain judgments from some of these
I'm learning that. To be fair, I am learning that it is a genuine litmus test to come up against this Mexican team. Look, for example, at the next competitive games you're going to have. It's going to be Canada and Cuba in the CONCACAF Nations League. So I understand your frustration. And I also talk ad nauseum on this podcast about the World Cup qualifying campaign that used to be where you played all of the honeymoon destinations and then you ended up with the serious stuff in the hex. Now that's going to change, obviously. It's going to be a new format. But I understand your frustration. And I would accept that Friday night's game was a chastening experience. It was a competitive game in everything but the fact that there was no points handed out at the end of it.
Correct.
Absolutely happy to say that. Once that ball was kicked, it was competitive. It mattered. And I guess I'm learning that. And don't be too harsh on us European guys. But
No. I'm just trying to explain our mindset.
Right.
Where, like, we kind of have to look at these games a little bit differently because we just don't have the pool of games to choose from in which to do that.
But I would say some of the frustration that I felt came out of the fact that it was Mexico again. All right, we should be ready for them. What have we learned? How have we progressed? That was part of it. The other part of it was we saw some of our cause celebres, like people who have been clamoring for Dest to come into the team. And he comes into the team, and what happens? He gets ripped a new one by an experienced player on the right-hand side in Tecatito. So that's a disappointment straight away. And, you know, the team was not what people wanted to see against Mexico. It was Zardes again. It was Will Trapp again. You know what I mean? So there was a sense of deflation before the ball was kicked. And then in the couple of selections that people were happy with, they saw Pulisic in the team. They saw Dest in the team. You know, then there was that disappointment because it all fell apart a little bit. And then you throw in the systems element, which people are so hung up on now.
Let's talk about that.
That was the main thing that came out of this. That was the one that constantly was a back and forth on Twitter. Some people saying, well, look, if we're not going to do it against Mexico and try it in a game that doesn't matter, when are we going to do it? We have to work the process. I'm hearing a lot about the process. Mm-hmm. And then other people who are like, you know, this just doesn't work. We're, to quote Alexi Lalas, we're painting the Sistine Chapel with crayons, which I think was, he was trying to be evocative and colourful, but I think it was a bit harsh. But, you know, this was the culture war we emerged with from this game. It was all about systems and styles. And that was the main debate that we were left with.
So I actually firmly fall on one side of that debate. And it is the side of if not now, when? Like, say whatever you want about the appointment of Berhalter and the style in which he wants to play, but let's at least all agree he wants to try to play this in vogue style of playing out from the back.
Very much so.
And so whether you like it or not, like, that's what he's going to try to do.
Mm.
So if that's, like, that being what it is this not the perfect time to do that? Even when things are going horribly wrong in front of you, in some respects, that I almost feel like that's a good thing. Like, learn from these moments. If not now, when? You want to have a style. Like, we all as American fans, we watch the Premier League. We see the best teams are typically playing that style. And I know that, obviously, the U.S. aren't of a caliber of Manchester City or teams like that. But this is a style that works for a lot of teams. And maybe, who knows, maybe we'll get to a point where it will become untenable and we'll realize, look, we just simply don't have the personnel to do this. But we're not at that point yet. These are the games where you have to find out whether or not this is something you can do down the line.
Do you think Walker Zimmerman or Aaron Long are capable of being comfortable on the ball and playing in that system from the back?
Right now, no. But I'm more than happy to live through the bumps and bruises of finding that out with my own eyes rather than just thinking it.
Now, Zimmerman, I've been told regularly, although I'm not sure I see it, and I haven't seen him play well for LAFC in a while, even though I know he has because they're winning games, but I saw what Zlatan Ibrahimovic did to him. I know for a fact that Aaron Long certainly doesn't play that style at the Red Bulls. So now you're talking about a period of time, and a fundamental question for international managers. Do you have the time with a group together, like a club team has, to institute a style as demanding as this one, as technically demanding, as tactically demanding as this? Probably not.
No, and that is the frustrating thing. But that's also, that's another reason why I
feel
like
you have
to do it.
So he's not painting the Sistine Chapel with crayons. He's painting the Sistine Chapel with crayons, but he's doing it in installments. So he has to do the Sistine Chapel once every 4 months.
Right. Really, he's painting the Sagrada Familia more than the Sistine Chapel, right? Isn't that the one in Barcelona that's being painted like forever? There's no way. Actually, I think they are ending.
Got to pretend I have culture.
What I'm talking about. I win! I found something that he doesn't know about that he should!
Let's get back to soccer. Anyway, can I make my point that I've made all along? What I felt was most disheartening was the slavish, almost, how would you put it? Rigid acceptance of playing from the back trademark. Look at the second goal. That's one where you expect Zach Steffen to put his shoe through the ball, not play it back there.
Right.
Just leather it down the field, drive it down the field. There were other times when Steffen was on the ball where he could have looked to beat the Mexican press. Mexico had us figured out so early that they rushed four players, two forwards and two midfielders, to close us down. Mm. What does that require? It requires a driven ball over the top to beat the press, and it creates space in behind the Mexican attack. We never did it. Not once. Playing out from the back does not mean playing out from the back every time. Don't take away the agency of your players. If you take away agency and thoughtfulness and mindfulness on the ball, you're setting them up for failure. Manchester City do not pass out from the back every single time. They look to play out from the back when it's on, and with their movement and the movement in front of them of the midfielders, it's regularly on. And if it's not, what have we seen the goalkeeper do at Manchester City? Regularly, Ederson just
he'll fire one into space 70 yards downfield and see if Aguero can run into it. Yeah.
Right. Now, we probably weren't set up for that. We probably didn't have a centre forward. Like, I think Sargent can actually hold the ball up. But
he wasn't playing. Until the end.
But say he's not there. We didn't have a Josie to do that.
Right.
Who is a physical presence, at least. And Zardes, I mean, was just, he was in the Bermuda Triangle. He was not.
It's hard to be more invisible than he was in that game.
Right, but we never did it once, Andrew. Mexico figured us out and we couldn't think on our feet. So what I'm seeing in the progress of this system is a team that says we must do X or Y, but what if they do W? We don't know what to do.
Right. Yet, by the way, this is yet another reason why I'm glad they're doing it in this situation. Like, Zach Steffen can make that mistake on Friday night, so he now knows, okay, like, he now understands there's a time and a place for me doing this. Like,
now,
I now understand there is a moment where I should probably just leather this 160 yards downfield.
Now, let me keep ranting while I'm on this. There's a question as well about Trapp, Weston McKennie. When you play that style, you have to have a centre midfielder who's going to drop in on the half turn and quickly distribute the ball and not get caught in possession. I'm not sure that even Weston McKennie, as good as he is that kind of player. I actually think that Weston McKennie likes the ball in front of him so he can win tackles, initiate, get on the ball and play. Now, people will come back and say, well, he plays in so many positions for Schalke or has done. Who knows what his best position is? Granted, can Tyler Adams come in and win the ball off the back four, turn and do it. Maybe he can, but he wasn't there. So if, at some point, you do have to look at the strengths of the guys you've had. You can't just be blind to it and impose this system, this cookie cutter system upon them. It just doesn't work like that.
Yeah, I mean, look, you mentioned Tyler Adams. It's frustrating that we're not seeing him in these games. Tim Weah, it's frustrating. Like, Tim Weah feels like the perfect player to me in a game like that, who can like make runs with real pace and speed and try to like spread a back line or at least add some chaos to a midfield for Mexico that just looked so comfortable throughout the course of this game. Like, that's... Like, these are the moments where you want to see these guys so they can be learning along, right in lockstep with all these other young players. So, yeah, this was a frustrating night all around.
After the first 15 minutes, Andrew, what's the major thing we always come back to? We cannot keep the ball for sustained periods of possession. And for the first 15 minutes, we actually managed to knock it a few times against Mexico. It wasn't bad. The minute they got a foothold in the game, that was that. It was over.
We actually started, like you say, somewhat brightly. I thought Pulisic started well. Boy, the move that he had in midfield when he spun and turned the defender, I forget who it was, and then played the ball off, got it back. I mean, it was a pretty impressive individual effort.
Yeah, and it also suggested to me that maybe we're better in broken play. Maybe we're better. Like, I watched Northern Ireland play Germany yesterday, and Northern Ireland, the score 2-0 flattered Germany. Northern Ireland were really good pressing and hassling and harrying the Germans at times. Now, it's an exhausting way to play. But, you know, Berhalter talked about taking the game to people. I've seen, he laid out his two things in that first press conference, and I can't get away from it. One of them was, we're going to press teams. We haven't seen a coordinated press. That's the easy part to get right. Mm-hmm. And the other one was passing and playing through the thirds. And he's tried to implement that, and I don't think it's working.
No, right now it's not. That is evident in the results. The performances and the results right now, unfortunately, seem to be falling in line with one another. You could live with it a little bit if you felt like, okay, these guys are playing well, we're just not finishing opportunities. In fairness to the U.S., that happened a little in the Mexico game. You had Alfredo Morelos hit the post. You had the U.S. win a penalty that they were not able to convert. So you are talking about a couple opportunities there where maybe they could have at least gotten one goal. Mm. I mean, in the end, the U.S. and Mexico finished with the same number of shots on target. The U.S. actually finished with more possession than Mexico in this game, which I had to look at that stat like three times before I was like, wait a minute, that's a U.S. flag next to that 53% possession statistic. So
yeah, but
I think the score line kind of maybe is altering our perception a little bit. Although, I don't know, I feel kind of dirty saying that. I did not feel good about really any element of this game. It's a shame because someone like Sergiño Dest, we were so excited to see him out there wearing a U.S. uniform finally for the senior team.
Yeah.
And I thought he started well. You know, he looked confident.
It looked like it was going to be a battle.
Yeah, he fired a good attempt on net. And then Tecatito just took him apart. And you could see... I mean, you could really see his body language changed after that. And
yeah.
I felt for him because that's a horror moment to have in your debut performance.
I would say this. A lot of people jumped on Dest because we are so up and down with our reactions over players. And look, there is a guy playing for England tonight who won a Champions League at fullback in Trent Alexander-Arnold and considered one of the best attacking fullbacks in the game. I saw him get absolutely destroyed by Mendes Lang of Cardiff in a game leading, you know, in the league game last year. So fullback is a weird position, by the way, and it's dictated often by what's in front of you. And unfortunately for Dest, he had Pulisic on that side who was trying to be all things to all men, get forward a lot, and he was often exposed. And in that first move, that first goal, the move that led to it, Pulisic's attempted tackle was pretty weak as well. And the next thing, Dest is just on the half turn, he's a little bit square, he's not quite in the right body shape, and the minute he nutmegs him, there is no recovery.
No.
Now, there was no marking in the box either. I mean, it was...
There were failures all over the place.
There was multiple failures, but I would just say about Dest, if you think as a defender that you've seen some weaknesses, you will see it in a young defender, you will also see it in most defenders and fullbacks these days. The days of like the Dennis Irwins and the DeMarcus Beasleys, who were really good on both sides of the ball, probably doesn't exist anymore. They are very much two-way players. And I, I, I just don't want to kill the guy over.
Of course not.
It can happen, and it regularly happens to guys we consider the very best in their position.
Absolutely. Look, if you play a defensive position, you're going to get embarrassed. It's 100%. At some point, Virgil van Dijk is going to get embarrassed by somebody. There's a certainty.
Look at De Ligt lately as well. I mean, right. He's had a really rough baptism of fire.
Was there when it happened? Was there any part of you like? So I'm watching that, and as it's transpiring. You know, it's hard to be watching Sergiño Dest right now without having that kind of like seed in the back of your mind of he's never going to play for us. He's never going to play for us. He's going to go to the Netherlands. He's going to play for the Netherlands. So when that happened, I was like, oh, the Dutch won't approve of that.
Yeah, you know what? They won't like that one little bit.
Oh.
Well, I thought of that.
Fail more.
Fail harder right now. I thought more the opposite because I watched Danny Blind defend on the Danny Blind? That's his dad. Daley Blind.
Yeah.
The son. I saw Daley Blind defending on Germany's first goal and thought, oh, there's actually a place for
him.
A left-sided player.
Do you have any sense right now of what the preferred 11 is for this US team? Like you and I were talking before, like while the game was going on, we were watching it to stick with a fullback position for a sec of like, you know, all of a sudden it feels like there's actually some kind of a wealth of talent there. If Dest does, if Yedlin ever gets healthy, if Dest does declare for the U.S. I mean, we used to be in this turnstile of Bornstein and Beasley and Viafania. Like, you know,
I think you could see a Cannon, Long. He really likes Long.
Yeah.
Cannon, Long, Brooks, if he's ever fit again or ever.
Let's pretend everyone's healthy.
Cannon, Long, Brooks, Dest, because Dest is going to be, we expect him to be, a Champions League starting fullback. So you would expect him to come in there. That potentially could be it.
Yeah.
But you're right. If suddenly what we thought was written in stone, well, certainly me and you did, we had a preferred back four in our minds. And I think that's probably, that's in flux now.
Well, it is. But like, what about the fact that Greg Berhalter, and again, we haven't seen this because he's been hurt, but you know, Berhalter seems to prefer Tyler Adams at a fullback position. That can't continue to be the case, can it?
Well, de facto fullback, but actually sliding into the midfield to do those kind of runs in the channels.
Uh-huh.
But we don't know if he's abandoned that. We haven't seen it. We only saw it once, really.
Yeah,
so
we don't know.
So we don't know.
No, we really don't. Yeah, we're coming out of this international break, even with a 1-1 draw against Uruguay, who are very highly rated as a team. I know they're without Suarez, without Cavani, but we're leaving this international break not feeling much better about the U.S. than we did following the Gold Cup,
no,
unfortunately.
And unfortunately, we're entering competitive games that we will win. We should win anyways. I expect us to win. And really what's on the table now is we're looking at what's his preferred 11 going to be, and also can we lock down Sergiño Dest in that time after what we read in the Dutch newspapers last week where their under-23 coach wanted to speak to him before he went on international duty with the US, didn't get a chance, but said it's a matter of quote-unquote urgency that they speak to him.
He's gone, man. In my mind, he's gone.
Really?
No, yeah.
Is this just your general negative take on life, or is there something?
No, I've been talking to him regularly.
Don't say that. As journalists, we shouldn't say that. As broadcasters, we should not put that doubt in people's minds.
I speak to him on a daily basis.
People are asking me, do I think he'll do a Declan Rice on us? I don't know the lad. I've never really. I would have liked him to be more committed coming into this round of games, but that's not what we heard from him. So,
but like, by the way, to U.S., let's say it does happen. And he does bolt for the Netherlands. Like, let's all be, we're getting into like weird territory here because we talk about how nationality is very complex.
Yeah.
But like, if that happens, can we all at least be mature about it and understand it and not like bombard this guy's Twitter account with hate? Like, come on, American fans. Like, you guys have to understand that this kid grew up in the Netherlands, plays for like the preeminent Dutch club in Ajax. Like, let's all be honest with one another here. Like, he probably, gun to his head, I'm sure he feels Dutch. Like, how could he not? He's playing for the U.S. because, yes, he has a father who is American. Mm. And you know, who knows? When the U.S. first approached him about playing through their youth teams, he may not have ever thought there was really any future for him on a more competitive Dutch side. He might have thought his future from an international perspective was only through the U.S. But things have changed, and he has risen. And his profile has risen within his own country. So, like, let's all understand that if he does make that move, it, like, no one's being caught off guard here. It's not a crazy thought that he would do this. Like, so I think I'm already putting up my, like, defense mechanisms and bracing myself for what, for a thing that I completely understand if it happens. And I might have even done the same thing if I were him.
It's totally within the rules as well. And we have very, very recent, you know, we have a recent kind of precedent set by Declan Rice, who had three senior caps.
Yeah.
Before he went for England.
Dest is already a two. So, and he's played in a US-Mexico game. Like, they threw him into the fire.
Yeah, and who knows? He may have created such a bond with those players that he played at the youth tournaments with, and maybe coming over and back to the United States has created that love in his heart. We just don't know, but we should be prepared for the worst, potentially.
Yeah, a couple other things before we get off of this and take a break here. I just wanted to say that after a promising start, Tyler Boyd has plateaued very quickly, in my mind. Look, limited opportunities. I'm not passing any judgments whatsoever. Maybe a few moments here and there. He did play a good ball in tonight to Jordan Morris, who headed it, and it was a nice save from Muslera. Yeah. But, you know, he was, again, he was Zardes-esque in terms of invisibility against Mexico.
And again, I do feel for him, where was the ball directly being played to him if it's not being passed through that Mexican press, which it wasn't. So he was isolated a little bit, but at the same time, yeah, not evident. I wonder what happened maybe in terms of his, he must have felt comfortable as he came through the Gold Cup. And then he was dropped unceremoniously for the semi-final and final, not featuring even off the bench, which really puzzled me. So maybe there's that little bit of residual, where do I stand here?
Yeah, but hey, well, where you stand is Berhalter, he went right back to you.
Yeah.
You know, he played you in these games, so, you know, it's not like he has fallen out of favor necessarily. I guess the big winner here for me would be Jordan Morris, just, you know, guy coming off a catastrophic knee injury, comes back and now looks to be playing as good as ever. You know, even aside from the goal tonight, the ball that he played in where Tyler Boyd had, like, how did Boyd not score on that ball across goal? So, yeah, I thought if we're coming away with any positives from these last few days, for me, Jordan Morris would probably be my number one there.
Ream was fairly decent tonight.
Yeah, that's fair.
Yep.
I felt good for him going back to his hometown.
It's not a lot, folks. It's not a lot.
And it's going to be hard to come away with too many takeaways, especially from the Uruguay game and from a Mexico game where the U.S. were on their heels for most of the match. So, yeah, not great. And unfortunately now we kind of enter this, like you mentioned, this like continued nether zone now, where how much are we really going to be able to take away from anything that happens over the course of the next several months?
The only thing is, at least these games are put down as competitive games and we can at least approach them in a serious manner. Not that we didn't in the last two. You know what I mean, though? We can kind of go, okay, this is what we did for the early rounds of the Gold Cup. You know, this is us.
Oh, look, we'll get excited about anything.
Yeah, that's true.
But it would be nice to be playing some matches of consequence.
Soon enough, my friend. That year will come around quickly.
What, qualifying?
Yeah.
It's literally a year from now, right?
I think.
Where it begins?
Yeah, I think so.
Yeah. I'll tell you what, we'll take a very quick break. When we come back, we've got, you have a nice mailbag that you prepared. I know that there were a few other thoughts from things that happened in Europe and stuff that you do want to get into. We've got some good NWSL, MLS, EPL, what to watch for. So don't go anywhere. There's still a lot to do. Oh, back now on Caught Offside. JJ, last bit, there was a quote here that I wanted to read. About the U.S. men, because I can already feel, you know, people getting angry about, you know, the idea that I believe in, which is that these are the games where, like, because I saw on Twitter how, all the rage from people who were just like, why are they doing this? Stop this. Enough with the off from the back. And Reggie Cannon, leave it to like a 21-year-old kid to have like the quote to me that really resonates and sums it up. He said, That's actually the big point that people are failing to grasp. You can't abandon the concepts when things get hard, because that way we won't improve. In 2 years, we're going to be in the same spot. When things get tough like that, when you come in against the Mexico team that is pressing the heck out of you, you have to learn how to play out. Unfortunately, that's going to come with mistakes. And that's exactly how I felt. Like, these are the, like, for it to possibly pay off for you later, you've got to go through the rough patches now. So good work, Reggie Cannon.
Yeah, fair. And I'm not saying stop it, but I'm also saying don't take away your agency. Don't take away your decision-making skills. You know when it's on, you know when it's not.
Other things happening around the world, JJ, lots of European qualifying. England just, they've now gone through, how many years of it, has it been since they lost a qualifying match?
Oh, it's a long,
long
time.
Has it been 10 years?
It's I think it's a decade. Unbelievable.
Watching them, what a weird game today against Kosovo. They go down in the first minute, which, you know, this bizarre gut punch to start out, and then they come right back, Raheem Sterling in the eighth, Harry Kane then shortly after that. Next thing you know, at halftime, it's 5-1, and then Kosovo come back with two more to kind of like a game that I had mentally abandoned.
Right.
Then all of a sudden it's 5-3 with a lot of time left, and you're like, oh, if Kosovo can get one more here, this could get fascinating. But England were able to see it out, as you would expect.
Yeah,
Kane missed a penalty.
There wasn't that much great, clever defending in that second half from England to kind of let Kosovo back in. And Kosovo were relentless, to be fair to them. We'll talk more about them a little bit later. But England, they still haven't really figured out that midfield for me. What's key now for them is Raheem Sterling. He is absolutely the heartbeat of that team, because the second goal was so of his making. The ball comes into him, Andrew, with his back to goal, and he spins the defender and bears down on that Kosovo defence, slips it off to Harry Kane, who buries it. Now, it's a great finish by Kane, don't get me wrong, but that's all Sterling. He's the dynamo of this side. It's amazing how the narrative on Sterling in England has changed. He went, what, 2 years without scoring a goal?
Oh, he can't... I'm not going to do your English, your angry English
voice. No, Sterling, he's all right if you're playing Premier League, but he can't finish for England. He just can't find the net. Which is just not true. And definitely the Kosovo manager actually spoke about it afterwards and said that once upon a time Sterling wasn't the most polished finisher, but Pep Guardiola has improved that part of his game. Whatever, he is key for them now. He is the kind of creative fulcrum in that side. And
if I'm an England fan and I'm watching today, and you know they now have, like, we're talking about waves and generations of talent coming through. For England, you've now kind of identified the general core: Sterling, Kane. I guess you would say Harry Maguire. I feel like you can kind of see this. But if I'm a fan and I'm watching England today, and I'm now seeing Jadon Sancho enter the mix, and I'm thinking, oh my God, like, here's this play. This is like found money. Like, this player that we're not even really accustomed to, because he's not playing in our league. So it's not like he's really on the forefront of England fans' minds. And all of a sudden he shows up and it's like, oh my God, this is amazing. How good might we be? This kid is still a baby.
I agree and I concur with all of that. But I just keep thinking that the things that have caught them in the past, controlling the midfield, being in possession of the ball, they made a great start against Croatia, don't forget, in that World Cup semi-final, and it all ebbed away because slowly but surely they were ground down by Modric in midfield, and I just don't see that player yet. I don't think Declan Rice is that player, but I think he's definitely going to start there at the base for England, and I think they have to figure out who goes with them. It was Ross Barkley and Henderson today in that midfield three, and I'm not sure that's going to cut it when they come up against the good teams, but there's a good chance they won't meet a really top team until the European Championships next. Well, it isn't. There's not a good chance. It is the fact that they will go into a tournament having not been tested.
Let's keep it to just European Championships for a sec. Who are the other European nations that you could sit here with confidence and say they're definitely better than England?
I think France are better than England. I think Spain are still better than England for those very reasons I just talked about. Control of the midfield, being able
noises.
To... Now, there's loads of people can throw it back in my face and say, well, is winning the midfield battle that important anymore, JJ? Maybe not. Maybe if you're a team that can counterattack, maybe it's not. But yeah... Never write off the Germans.
Yeah.
Although I would write off the Germans.
Okay, what about the Dutch?
they're in a bit of, they're saucy.
Them and when England, I feel mood, like, are both in the midst
the
of kind
Dutch,
of a...
The Dutch, yeah, of a bit of a comeback. Yeah. Well, England have been kind of there or thereabouts, particularly with that World Cup run, whereas the Dutch have been off the radar for two tournaments.
Yeah.
And Koeman has seemed to reinvigorate them a little bit. They were good against Germany in that game. That was a fun game, Andrew.
4-2.
It was. And yeah, you know what? If it wasn't for the weirdest handball you'll have seen in a long time on Frankie de Jong, where the ball is in the air, deflected up in the air, he can't see it, and it lands on his arm, and the referee gives a penalty. If it wasn't for that, that's 4-1. I feel as if the two puts a gloss on it. I thought the Dutch were excellent. The Malin goal was absolutely fantastic. Arsenal reject, by the way. Where he comes off the bench and Wijnaldum is running, breaking. Again, the Dutch played on the break, by the way, a lot, which was interesting. And Wijnaldum just breaks down the left-hand side. Depay gets the ball, rolls in, a brilliant run from Wijnaldum. And Andrew, he just flicks it with the outside of his boot and leaves it at a lovely height for Malin to volley it home. The Dutch, they're so weird, though. There are weird things about the Dutch. Like, I look at the team and I'm like, hey, you know what? There's Virgil van Dijk. There's Frankie de Jong. There's Matthijs de Ligt. Yeah, there are those players. But there's also like this kind of weird hybrid where there's Ryan Babel in there.
Scored twice today.
I know, but you would have expected the Dutch team would not be returning to him at this point. There's Daley Blind still in the side. There's a rejuvenated Memphis Depay. They're this weird hodgepodge of unwanted toys that have all come together under Koeman and have somehow found a rhythm. They're not perfect, but I'd fancy them. If it came to a semi-final against England of a major tournament, I'd still fancy them more than I would England.
Belgium?
Belgium are the best team in the world right now, in my view. Belgium and Brazil.
Okay. Wow, what a insult to France. What else does France have to do to get your respect?
Yeah, I suppose they throw France in there by the sheer weight of quality in their squad. Yeah, okay. But I have a real thing for the way Belgium play, and France don't play. France have maybe better personnel across 40 players, but I kind of prefer watching Belgium.
Should have lost to Japan.
They really should have. I love watching Japan, though. Oh. International football is fun. I don't care what anyone says. It's fun.
Yeah, it has been. It seemed like you had other things that you wanted to get off your chest.
No, I just a little bit about the Germans.
Yeah.
I was looking at the team against obviously in the Dutch game, and then I saw them against Northern Ireland, and yeah, they were better in the second half against the North. It was 0-0 at halftime, but just looking through the squad, Andrew, it's diminished. It's so diminished. Now, I know there was the purge that Yogi Löw had of players after the World Cup, of experienced players, where Hummels was out and Müller was out. But, you know, Gnabry is lively up front. Is he a top-end striker? Not sure about that. Royce is an excellent player. I will hang my hat on Royce. But, you know, he's had a lot of injuries. Timo Werner, I expected Timo Werner in these kind of games to thrive. I expected him to thrive in the World Cup last year, to be fair, as well. And for a guy who has, I think, 5 goals already in the Bundesliga this season, just not there. They're
in a period of a similar transition as to maybe what the Dutch were in a few years ago. Now, I don't know if Germany will fall to the sort of depths that the Netherlands fell to.
They probably won't.
Right. But, like, heading into next summer, I don't know that... we'll be talking about the Germans as our favorite.
No, but
maybe a top three.
We're
favorite.
So afraid of them because we saw a bad German team at Euro 96 win the whole tournament. Mm-hmm. So it's always in our minds that we can't write them off.
Yeah.
So we won't.
Speaking of which, we should also include Portugal in this conversation. Cristiano Ronaldo scored 4 today in a win against Lithuania. So he continues to just be such a force for
them. And he's scored now goals against 20 different countries.
Wow.
Which is...
Yeah, you wonder if there can be one last run from Portugal with Ronaldo combined with this. Like, they may catch this wave of Ronaldo still at the end of his prime mixed with João Felix, Bruno Fernandes, some of these young players at the beginning of theirs. And if they can peak at the same time, Portugal could still be a really scary team.
I think we've been disrespectful on two counts here. I'm going to say my count first. It's 40 different countries Ronaldo has scored against. 40.
That sounds better.
Yeah, it does. I knew it was wrong.
That sounds right.
I'm not good with numbers, and I knew even then that was wrong in my head. Yeah. It's crazy. It's a crazy amount. Second of all, why aren't we talking about the reigning European champions and the reigning Nations League holders as a real top team in the world? Why aren't we including them in this mix?
Well, I just brought them up.
I know, but I felt as if when you were asking me who's better than England or who's in that mold of top teams in Europe, the fact I didn't mention them is pretty disrespectful. You're right. You are going to get the tail end of Ronaldo with the João Felix and the Bernardo Silvas.
Absolutely. Mm. Absolutely. I'm sure we're leaving somebody out that will offend people. Italy, we haven't even mentioned Italy.
I know, but they're not exactly in the toughest group. No, not that that should matter, really, because there's no easy games in international football anymore.
That is false. That is a blatant falsehood, and I want to meet the person who believes that. The Faroe Islands play games.
All right. Okay.
All right. You have anything else? Or can I do stuff here?
No, we can do. What would you like to do?
I don't know if it's what you were thinking, but I want to do this.
Oh.
JJ, I want to tell you about ZipRecruiter. Hiring can be a slow process. I want to tell you something here. I want to tell you a story. Cafe Altura's COO, Dylan Miskowitz, needed to hire a director of coffee for his organic coffee company.
Uh-huh.
But he was having trouble finding qualified applicants. I know a lot about Dylan Miskowitz. I follow him at night. So he switched to ZipRecruiter. ZipRecruiter doesn't depend on candidates finding you. It finds them for you. Its technology identifies people with the right experience and invites them to apply to your job so you get qualified candidates fast. This is what Dylan did, JJ. He posted his job on ZipRecruiter, said he was impressed by how quickly he had great candidates apply. He also used ZipRecruiter's candidate rating feature to filter his applicants so he could focus on the most relevant ones. And that is how Dylan found his new director of coffee in just a few days.
He worked the process.
With results like that, it's no wonder that 4 out of 5 employers who post on ZipRecruiter get a quality candidate within the first day. See why ZipRecruiter is effective for businesses of all sizes. Try ZipRecruiter for free at our web address, ZipRecruiter.com/offside. That's right, offside. That's ZipRecruiter.com/offside, OFFSIDE, ZipRecruiter.com/offside. ZipRecruiter, the smartest way to hire. Good for Dylan. Good for Dylan Miskowitz.
I love those uplifting stories about made-up people that you tell us.
How dare you? Cafe Altura Dylan Miskowitz. Google him right now,
I will.
Oh, JJ, let's see. You have a mailbag prepared, I believe.
At CUSoccerPod, caughtoffsidepod@gmail.com. CaughtoffsideESPN on the Instagram. Andrew, the kids love the pictures. Get on Instagram, caughtoffsideESPN. Follow us. Send us a message.
You just posted a beautiful Instagram video. You came in tonight with an amazing gift for my new son, Luke. You have this, and you post. You had this unveiling, handing me the gifts.
Yes,
and it's a wonderful video. It'll warm all of your hearts.
If you want to see the heartwarming video, get over to Caught Offside ESPN. Do yourselves a favor.
Yeah,
Matt McGee. Hi lads, this is a good question. Do either of you have a kit from a player that didn't work out for club or country? I have a mixed Discarude USA jersey hanging next to my Man United Mkhitaryan and Memphis Depay kits at home. What a double whammy! I'm just going to answer this quickly. I don't. I bought a lot of jerseys with no names on them, and I followed the great advice of my Liverpool supporting friend Eric, who said you do not get a new signing on your jersey until at least after a season or two. You just don't do it. Legends, fine. Established players, fine. Never a new signing. My friend John, who supports United, has Angel Di Maria on the back of his United jersey.
I should have followed that advice before I got my Vincent Janssen jersey. Just kidding. Yeah, the jersey. So, like you, the vast majority of jerseys that I have no names on them. The ones that do, I have a Raul Real Madrid jersey.
Okay.
And I have a...
Established.
And right, I think that doesn't fit the bill here. But what about... Actually, this one also doesn't fit. This is... Now, you talk about random. I don't even know how I wound up with this. JJ, I have a Milan Baroš Czech Republic jersey. I'm not kidding.
Baroš is a club legend or a cult hero kind of... Well, is he a cult hero at Liverpool?
You would know better than me.
I don't know. He doesn't come up that much.
So then probably not.
But I mean, he was part of the team that won the Champions League.
Yeah.
He was frustrating as a striker.
Yeah. I have it right next to my Vladimir Smitser Liverpool jersey. No, but my Milan Baroš is a Czech Republic one, and he probably is beloved for them.
Yeah.
So, yeah.
Weird.
So weird.
Ex-Musketeer got caught up in the comments of a recent NPR article on the dangers of heading in soccer. Several individuals are under the belief they should simply remove heading from the game. Am I crazy, or is that as asinine as I think it is? Also, congratulations on the junior Gundling. Well, ex-Musketeer, that is not the first time I've heard about this. But the idea that it would be a simple task to take heading out of the game is just ridiculous. I remember Michael Calley tweeting about allowing only headers in the box, that you would limit the amount of headers in a game by only having offensive box headers. Now, I ridiculed it at the time, but the science is catching up on this area. There may come a time when it's going to be outlawed. This is from the Washington Post in 2016. Amy Ellis Nutt. Routine heading of a soccer ball can cause damage to brain structure and function, according to a new study from the United Kingdom that is the first to detect direct neurological changes by impacts too minor to cause a concussion. The research, published this week in eBioMedicine, studied brain changes among amateur players aged 19 to 25 who headed machine-projected soccer balls at speeds modelling a typical practice. Though the results seen were temporary, the trigger questions about possible cumulative damage done over time. So that's not concussive blows to the head, but just regular heading.
Right. It's like what they talk about with offensive linemen and defensive linemen. Like, those guys don't experience the same kind of, like, traumatic hit that a wide receiver might take when going over the middle when he gets leveled.
Yeah.
But they are the ones that repeatedly, play after play, just
are
like
getting those
kind of
hits.
Like subtle bang, yeah. bang, bang, and the cumulative effect of that kind of like builds up in a more dangerous way, potentially.
Yeah.
I'm thinking more about Michael Calley's idea, only allowing them in the 18-yard box. That is interesting to me because oftentimes, I mean, think of a lot of the headers that would eliminate. A goalkeeper smashing one 70 yards at pace, coming down at a steep angle. Like, you know, we don't think anything of it, but heading that is not, like, you feel that.
Yes, you do. And if you catch it on the top of your head, you particularly feel
it.
Also, as well, flick-ons, you know, what would happen to that? A ball that's bouncing, which is a gentle header, I can't flick that on now. If I'm trying to take it past a player and it's at head height, I can't nod it ahead of myself. The NPR people that were in the comments there that think it would be simple are wrong. It would change the game. You would have to allow a huge amount of arm play for guys to try and chest control. It would change the physicality of the game massively.
That's an interesting question. And for him to say it's an asinine idea, I don't believe that it's asinine.
No, it's not.
But I understand why soccer fans would kind of be disgusted at having these conversations because it's so ingrained in the sport. But I think people need to start wrapping their minds around stuff like this.
But we do. And also, we got to go back to believing in experts again. Somewhere along the line, we've stopped doing that. But they know what they're talking about. The research is there.
I don't mean to cut you off, but I just pulled up a score in front of me.
Okay.
And I'm wondering what this will do to the psyche of the American soccer fan.
Can you hit the breaking news button, please? Standards, Andrew.
So by now you're all listening to this and you know the final score of the Argentina-Mexico game. You and I, however, are living in the present.
Yes.
Where things are still happening. Mexico are playing like superstar players tonight. Irving Lozano started, Raul Jimenez, Hector Herrera, Jonathan Dos Santos, Miguel Layún, Carlos Salcedo, Tecatito starting again. Like, they got a good group of players out there. It's halftime.
Yes, in San Antonio.
Argentina currently lead 4-0. Lucas Martinez already has a hat trick.
God.
What?
Across this great nation, and U.S. soccer fans' heads are exploding.
And JJ, if I start reading to you the players... not Lucas Martinez. Lautaro Martinez has the hat trick. If I start reading to you Argentina's lineup, you might be like, wait, what?
Go ahead. Just give me some names.
Marcus Rojo, Lucas Martinez, Leandro Paredes, Nicolas Tagliafico, Gonzalo Montiel, Ezequiel Palacios, Rodrigo De Paul, Marcos Acuna, Alexis McAllister, Lautaro Martinez. That is not Argentina's A squad by any means.
No.
Mexico are playing theirs. Mexico just thrashed the U.S., and Mexico are now getting thrashed. Therefore, by the associative property, the U.S. are now on equal footing with the Barbados.
I'm going to need the sad walking away music before I even read the next email.
Huh.
Oh. Oh, dear. Andrew?
Yeah?
Can I ask you a question?
Sure.
Are we bad at soccer?
We're in a transition, all right? And that is what we are calling it.
Okay. Matthew Enzo brings us back to the real world with a thump. Are the racists or ultras?
Jeez.
I know, straight into it. Ugh. Are the racists or ultras like the Curva Nord who defend racist abuse actually fans of the game of football, or is football just a tribal platform that gives them a safe-ish space from which they can shout their racism? I'm assuming at this point that most people have seen the response that the Curva Nord supporters group of ultras delivered about the Cagliari fans and why they aren't racist for making monkey noises at Romelu Lukaku, their player.
That made it almost even more disappointing than the Cagliari fans doing that in the first place.
It was to compound an error with a bigger error, take something in this scenario. I would just say,
if your fans do that and you're Lukaku, how do you go back out there and play for them?
Can I be honest with you? Contracts notwithstanding, I'd be on a plane. This is big talk for a white man sitting in a studio, but yeah. I would not for one second, not for one second, criticize Romelu Lukaku if he said, "Sorry guys, I'm out of here."
And like, not to look, this is a unique set of fans that we're referring to, if you even want to call them fans, ultras, whatever.
They're the same people who abused Koulibaly last season.
But you hear this stuff, and like, it's no wonder that the state of player-fan interaction kind of is what it is. Like, I feel like fans have never really been more removed from these players that they follow. Now, you see situations where that's not always true. Social media can sometimes connect people in positive ways.
Yeah.
And we do try to highlight positive stories here. But overall, there's a rift between players and then fans slash media. And this is why. Stuff like this.
I would just say about Matthew's point on safe spaces in which the ultras feel safe to shout this filth. Let's put it in context. Italian Deputy Prime Minister Matteo Salvini, in downplaying the abuse that Koulibaly received at the hands of Inter fans last year, talked about healthy teasing. Right? Mm-hmm. Italy's first black minister, Cecile Kyenge, received racist abuse from members of the Italian parliament. So if elected officials speak in this manner, can we really be so shocked to see it reflected in football stadiums? Isn't it just what John Barnes said? There's racism rampant in Italian society, and it's manifesting itself in football stadiums.
Yeah.
Is this thing on? Has a question. How long until the Scottish FA clean house? So really tough defeat against Russia, where Scotland could have won, followed by a pummeling at the hands of a KDB-inspired Belgium. You could say Kevin De Bruyne raptured Belgium into heaven with that performance.
People have said that.
People are saying that. About cleaning house, they did clean house. They appointed Steve Clarke in May. I think they've been unlucky. I think they could have beaten Russia, and to meet Belgium is just bad luck at this time. They were ripped apart. I like Steve Clarke. I think they need to stick with him. There's no point switching. There is no panacea for Scottish football in a manager. Just isn't. Avery DeMar, he's made a cardinal error in bringing us this excellent news. He goes, 18, wow, just wow, way to go, boys. Phoenix Rising. Caught offside. Does that get your attention? Then later, a day later, Oh man, JJ and Andrew, I've been tagging the wrong Atsio Soccer Pod. They don't like Phoenix Rising, but I know you will. And I said, Avery, we shall respond next week. Long overdue. Andrew, Phoenix Rising are top of the USL Championship and in the midst of an 18-game winning streak that is just unprecedented. What an amazing winning streak. And they are unbeaten on Dollar Beer Night since 2017. Since Dollar Beer Night was instituted for the Rising, they have not been beaten. There's a really nice piece by Josh Weinfuss on Phoenix Rising and their Dollar Beer Night exploits on ESPN FC. But reading the article, it's so hot down there that Dollar Beer Night is just a brilliant idea. Not that it's going to, you know, hydrate you, but a cool beer on a hot evening watching soccer is amazing. At one game in July, they sold 20,000 cans of beer. 20,000! I mean, the ground only holds, what, 7,000 or 8,000?
Oh my God.
Amazing. Often the players are doused in beer by their own fans. It's such a celebration of both beer and soccer down there. And by the way, lots of people have been in touch with us. I had a guy email us to tell us the whole story. People have been hassling us to talk about Phoenix Rising forever. And I've steadfastly refused.
I know, because you think nothing of lower league football.
That's not true. You're the one
that's pathetic and it's wrong.
No, it's the vibes I get.
And
from,
I've long felt that way.
We need to get down there. They need to invite
to
us down.
To Phoenix?
For Dollar Beer Night, yeah.
Yeah, that sounds amazing. Let's go. But like...
they should invite us down. They invited the night from the Bud Light
so
commercials.
So you're going to get on a plane and you're going to go?
I'll do
if
it.
If you do it, all right. Who are you going to pay for my ticket too?
No, Phoenix Rising will. Brandon McCarthy and the guys that own the club.
What a game for them the other night, by the way. 1-0, scored in the 87th minute to get the win. I guess life after Drogba has been good.
Well, they've been really creative in maintaining buzz about the team. And hats off to them.
Yeah.
Well
done.
They
play Las Vegas tomorrow night.
Yes, they do. Ginger underscore Rail wants us to comment on the tragic passing of the woman who was on trial for attending a soccer game in Iran. Joe Prince-Wright of NBCSN wrote about it here. An Iranian woman who was set to be sent to prison for sneaking into a soccer game in Tehran has died after setting herself on fire. Since 1981, women have not been able to attend stadiums to watch male sporting events in Iran. Recently, many women have successfully disguised themselves as men to attend matches. Last week, the female fan, Sahar Kodiara, set herself on fire after her trial for trying to enter a stadium disguised as a man was postponed. She was initially charged in March and released from jail after 3 days, and she had waited 6 months for her trial. Reports suggest that after her trial was postponed, she returned to the courthouse and overheard somebody saying she would go to jail for 6 months to 2 years. Kodiara set herself on fire, and a week later she died in hospital from her injuries. She's known around the world as Blue Girl in reference to Esteghlal, the team in Tehran she supports. FIFA gave Iran a deadline of August 31st to allow women into stadiums, as President Gianni Infantino previously visited Tehran.
That's awful.
What else can you possibly say? But, you know, again, FIFA, what sanctions can they take? This is ridiculous in 2019 that women have to go to these lengths and end up dying over going to watch a soccer match. Like, there has to be some kind of stand FIFA can take on this. Finally, I say finally, it's not finally, Annie sent us word that Maradona has been unveiled as Gimnasia de la Plata head coach.
Uh-huh.
You don't care that Maradona is taking over an Argentinian soccer club?
I'm sure he'll do.
Have you seen the scenes?
No.
So they're nicknamed the Wolves. So he emerged from an inflatable wolf's head onto a field, into a stadium that was packed with supporters. He took a golf cart to the centre of the stadium, and he said this.
No,
he didn't. He didn't?
He didn't?
No.
So you mean... So he was not asked about the quality of Liga MX?
He was not asked about that. It was an unbelievable scene. He was so emotional, and he said what is really a great Maradona line, and this was the line. Le pido a mis jugadores me que se maten por toda esta gente. Which means, I ask my players to kill themselves for all these people. Which means, work really hard for the crowd.
Oh, thank God.
a slightly darker side to things. Not darker, but just very, I guess, Argentinian. The Daily Mail reported that Maradona led anti-English-like chants, including, "The one who does not jump is an Englishman." So Malvinas and the Falklands Island dispute has not been forgiven by one Diego Maradona.
There you go. Is that the mailbag?
That is the mailbag.
That was a hearty, hearty mailbag.
Did you enjoy it?
I did. I surely did.
I thought you'd be more taken by the Maradona stuff, but it is late at night, so.
Oh. I've slept little.
That's true.
Yeah.
With the baby.
Yeah, with the baby. Let's see. What to watch for time, JJ? NWSL Wednesday. We do have a lot of midweek action, both in women's and men's soccer. Wednesday, 10:30, Portland Thorns and North Carolina Courage. JJ, this is 1-2 in the table currently for the NWSL. Portland, the top on 36 points. North Carolina with 34 points, but they've played two fewer games. North Carolina's won 4 of their last 5. They're coming off a dramatic win against Sky Blue, who continue to struggle despite Carly Lloyd's exploits. But Crystal Dunn scoring the winner for North Carolina to keep their run of form intact. So this should be fun watching these two teams, right now the cream of the crop in NWSL. So looking forward to that, like I said, Wednesday night. MLS Wednesday night, 8:30 p.m., Houston Dynamo and Minnesota United FC, as the Western Conference playoff picture is still a complete jumble. I think it's something like 4 points separating 2nd through 8th. So while Minnesota United might be feeling very good about themselves right now, coming off a huge win against LAFC, nothing can really be taken for granted, is basically what I'm saying, because one loss and the dynamics of everything can change. LA Galaxy also in action Wednesday night against Colorado, I think. So a big night for a lot of those kind of mid-table sides in the Western Conference. And then Saturday, 7:30, Philadelphia coming off of one of the great wins in their young history over Atlanta. Not so young, I guess. They'll be right back at it again against previously mentioned LAFC, who are kind of hitting, I don't know, a bit like they've lost to Minnesota. Previously before that, the draw with the Galaxy. Then they had the draw over the weekend against Orlando City.
Yeah.
So, you know, maybe they're in that kind of, like, remember last season where it was Atlanta who were so dominant, so dominant, so dominant. And then I think you just mentally get to this place of, okay, we know we're good. Get me to the playoffs already. Everyone stay healthy. And like New York Red Bulls last year were able to kind of then at the last second get past Atlanta for the
Supporters' Shield. It's got to be strange to be so far ahead as they are in their conference and then realize that none of these games actually matter right now.
They're not going to lose their spot atop the conference.
There's huge games coming up over the horizon, and you're probably starting to think, well, should we taper this off? Maybe is training being tapered off a bit so they've got something in the tank for the...
Who knows?
I don't know. It's Zlatan talked about... Well, he talked about a lot of things earlier in the season, but he did mention how it is very, very different, the mentality towards the regular season as opposed to the postseason.
Yeah. Let's see, JJ. EPL, it returns Saturday, 7:30 a.m. You'll be up nice and early for Liverpool and Newcastle.
Yes, indeed, sir. Looking forward to that one. Yeah. And, it's interesting that I suppose the most exciting game towards the end of last season was this fixture, although it was at St. James's Park.
One of the many Divock Origi games.
This one is interesting to me because Liverpool will be fully expected to win it, but we've seen something of a Brucey bump prior to the break. There was a bit of a leveling off after that amazing win against Spurs. There was a draw that followed that, but at the same time,
not a loss,
and a general feeling that, are we okay? Is this okay? And also, what I'd be interested to see is the away crowd. There's been a significant fall off in the home attendance. People have just not been turning up to a ground that St. James's Park that is perpetually full. I wonder, does that manifest itself in any kind of protest for the travelling support? I would doubt it, but we'll see.
Yeah. JJ, my favourite game of the weekend, Saturday, 10 a.m., Manchester United and Leicester City.
This is going to be a cracker.
Yeah.
It's the Maguire Derby, obviously.
Yep.
It's also a Brendan Rodgers going into Old Trafford. And I would think he does not fear what he sees in front of him.
No.
And I would think that they really fancy getting a big result here.
Yes, I wholeheartedly agree. I think they believe they're better.
I would think
so. Now, whether or not that's true, I don't know. But at this stage in the season, there's a conversation to be had, and I think what happens on Saturday will go a long way in determining how we feel about each of these teams.
Question, which are we more likely to see? A now trademark Daniel James curler into the top corner, or a now trademark Jamie Vardy wheeling away after he's just nipped one in around the goalkeeper?
I mean, since Brendan Rodgers has emerged for Leicester City as their manager, Jamie Vardy just seemed, he's like rediscovered
life.
Not that he fell off before that, but he's like Jamie Vardy of a few seasons ago right now under Rodgers.
He's showing tremendous character is what you're telling me.
And then another interesting one Saturday at 10 a.m. Good luck choosing between these two games. Wolves and Chelsea.
And another game where I know Wolves have been in a bit of a European funk, but at the same time, Chelsea coming off that 2-2 draw against Sheffield United. Now, no one can convince me that Wolves are not a better team than Sheffield United. And this is at Molineux. Is this another potential banana skin for Frank Lampard's revolution?
Definitely.
Yeah. These are good games.
Yes. And this, and Wolves-Chelsea is just perfectly timed. It's like a CONCACAF Cup. Raul Jimenez and Christian Pulisic.
What did you make of Wolves announcing? Everyone's announcing their third kits now.
Yeah.
So
You tore into Tottenham's. I thought it was actually pretty nice.
It's an Arsenal knockoff from a few years ago.
I don't know. All of these jerseys are knockoffs of each other.
They're knockoff of Arsenal and PSG and Nike jerseys and Italian Nike jerseys back in the day. But whatever. What do you make of Wolves and Jimenez, or using Jimenez and their Mexican connections with their away jersey, which is basically a Mexican away jersey? A Mexican home jersey. And Mexico don't wear green at this moment in time.
Yeah, I know. What do they do? I don't like seeing USA-Mexico with Mexico not wearing green. I feel like it doesn't look right.
Yeah.
What do I think of Wolves trying to capitalize on
the Mexican market, yeah.
Is it
cynical and clever?
Yes. Yeah, that sounds about right to me.
Okay.
Let's see, JJ, before we get to the final portion of the show, there's something I want to tell you about.
Are you trying to advertise more things?
I want to tell you about Cafe Altura.
Do you really?
And Dylan Miskowitz.
I want to know more about Dylan.
Well, guess what? Turn around. He's right behind you.
Oh,
Dylan, come
on.
No, he's not there. I want to tell you actually about Dollar Shave Club.
Oh, something we could use.
Yeah, Dylan is he's totally clean shaven because he believes in Dollar Shave Club. Now, when I and Dylan talk to you about Dollar Shave Club, we cannot stress enough the quality of these products.
This Walter Mitty character you've created.
The Dollar Shave Club has spent years developing, crafting, refining everything. They've got everything that I use to look and feel and, quite frankly, smell my best.
You're always well-smelling.
Yeah.
And you always have a nice shirt these days.
Yeah, you've said that. I don't know what that has to do with Dollar Shave Club, but I'll take the compliment. Now, I've used Dollar Shave Club. They have this, because I have sensitive skin, they have this, like, prep scrub.
Yeah.
I find it to be, I'm sure we have many other sensitive skin listeners out there. So this is a thing that I think could be helpful to you, the prep scrub in particular.
I always said that your skin gets quite blotchy, especially watching the U.S.
Sometimes
play.
It can get dried out, and I get this redness.
Ingrown hairs.
Now, you and I have beards, but that doesn't mean, for all our bearded listeners out there, it doesn't mean that this product is still not for you, because I shave the neck, I shave like the cheek portions to try to keep the beard in shape.
And so, you shave the gap between your eyebrows.
No, I don't do that.
You have Gallagher brother eyebrows, Noel and Liam. They join together.
I don't have a unibrow. What are you talking about?
Do you know
what a unibrow is?
It's because you keep it well shaved with Dollar Shave Club products.
These are lies. But as amazing as their shave stuff is, Dollar Shave Club is way more than just razors. Dollar Shave Club has you covered head to toe. Everything you need, from the shower to shaving to styling your hair to even brushing your teeth. And this is in the read. I just want to say that. But they want me to tell you that they even have products for wiping your butt.
Wow.
Dollar Shave Club.
Wow.
They can keep you automatically stocked up on the products you use. You get whatever you want, whenever you need it, whether it's once a month, a few times a year. Myself, Dylan, we've never had to waste time at a store wondering, what am I going to get? Is it any good? As any Dollar Shave Club member will tell you, you know you're getting the highest quality stuff all the time. Right now, you can put the quality of Dollar Shave Club's products to the test. The Ultimate Shave Starter Set has basically everything you need for an amazing shave. The Executive Razor, Shave Butter, prep scrub, post-shave do. The best part is you can try it now for just $5. After that, the restock box ships regular size products at regular prices. Get your ultimate starter set for just $5 at dollarshaveclub.com/offside. That's dollarshaveclub.com/offside. That's right, JJ. Even for wiping your butt, it's important that that was included.
Dylan, do you wipe your butt? No, he's gone.
Oh, that's too bad.
Red card.
You want to go first?
Yes. Andrew, have you seen Take Us Home Leeds United on Prime yet?
No.
Okay, good. Killing it already. Actually, I'm not saying Leeds United correctly because it should sound like this.
Leeds United.
Russell Crowe, of course, from Yorkshire, doing the narration. Well, Andrew, trouble is brewing up north. If you watch Take Us Home Leeds United, you'll see lovely little murals. You know what an electrical box is? You often see them on council estates and on streets in cities. They're right beside light poles usually. I'm presuming they're kind of circuit boxes. I've never known what's been in them.
But yeah, sure.
But they're usually like grey metal boxes on the side of the street.
Yeah.
Well, Andy McVeigh has spent the last 12 months coming up with creative designs to paint over graffiti or brighten up the dull electrical boxes and bollards, according to the Yorkshire Evening Post. Dubbed the Burly Banksy by his friends due to his art style and elusiveness, and he creates pieces for iconic moments throughout the history of Leeds United. And you see these, Andrew, featured on Take Us Home. However, 14 pieces of Andy's work have been covered over the weekend. The pieces covered include a poignant mural tribute to Gary Speed, which was painted over on the morning of his birthday by the group. Gary Speed, of course, who tragically died a few years back, the former Wales and Leeds player. Now, Leeds residents against graffiti have claimed responsibility for covering up these murals. In an email sent to the Yorkshire Evening Post, a member of the anonymous group said, "We had a trial run using red hammerite, which is a paint, on two boxes which had been covered by graffiti. The vandal," so they're describing Andy, this mural painter of Leeds United, as a vandal, then decided to repaint them, which was a foolish decision. "This looks much more dignified than the childish scrawl of a man who should be old enough to know better. Let's have an end to this graffiti." They added, "It is horrible stuff, but nothing will stick to it now. If he tries to paint over it, the new paint will just bubble off." The graffiti group, four members, including one driver and three brushes, claimed 11 reasons why they have covered up the graffiti. They are: "We represent the 90% of the citizens of Leeds who are not obsessed with Leeds United and do not need to see public areas painted with these mindless slogans." I'm not sure about their figures there, 90%. "We will break no laws and commit no crime. Private property and properly commissioned artwork will not be covered up. We will only paint over illegal graffiti. There are four of us in the painting crew, one van driver and three with brushes. We can cover all the Leeds United graffiti in one evening should we wish. We can cover up graffiti more quickly than this person can paint it. You call it mindless vandalism, which we find insulting. In fact, this is not mindless, and we have simply covered up unauthorised graffiti. We have no interest in soccer and have nothing against Leeds United or their fans, brackets, except disinterest." They go on to say they are not Manchester United fans. "It amuses us to read the slurs about insecurities and issues that this person accuses us of. We are not the ones with an obsession to paint graffiti on public property. We have no interest in meeting and having a coffee with this person. He simply needs to desist in his vandalism. All the Leeds United slogans and badges that he has painted will be covered by us." And he's gone on to say that he doesn't know what he's going to do. Will he keep painting over and try and keep painting murals? He's dismayed and angry and says it just makes no sense. Now,
we also hate joy and fun.
Like, I showed you some of these. Like,
yeah, no,
look
cool.
at the one at Gary
cool.
Speed.
Yeah.
Like, that's a nice guy who many people have lovely memories of in the city.
Like, who are these hurting?
Like, nobody.
Right.
But I actually think they brighten up the place a little bit.
Yeah. But that's obnoxious.
The extent to which they're going to is they're sending anonymous emails to the Yorkshire Evening Post like they're some kind of terrorist organization.
But they see themselves as some kind of vigilante.
Vigilante? What are you talking about?
That's
By the way, how sad are you?
Yeah.
How sad are you?
You're right. Get a hobby.
My God.
Yeah. My red card, JJ, I'll just read you this. This is from both Sky Sports and portions from ESPN FC as well. Danny Drinkwater will not be punished by Chelsea after he was allegedly attacked by a group of men while drunk outside a Manchester nightclub, Sky Sports News understands. Drinkwater, who is still battling for fitness after joining Sean Dyche's side, Burnley, on loan from Chelsea this summer, will reportedly meet the Burnley manager to discuss the attack and could be out of action for several weeks. Now, if you don't know, the incident that we're referring to took place outside of a nightclub in Manchester last weekend, and the incident reportedly left Drinkwater with a black eye, swollen forehead, bruised shoulders and arms, cut cheek, and torn ankle ligaments. He got into a fight. He was drunk. Got into a fight outside of a nightclub, reportedly over a woman who may or may not have been with somebody who is a player for another lower league side in England.
Okay.
The details are somewhat sketchy, but there was some kind of argument, and then a group of men, it sounds like, jumped him. And there were some reports where they were intentionally – they knew who he was. They knew that it was Danny Drinkwater. And it sounds like there were some reports there where they were intentionally trying to break his legs so as to affect his livelihood.
God.
There's reports that there were chants of break his legs, as guys just kind of jumped and, like, came down on with all their weight on his legs and ankles. It was really an ugly scene. Drinkwater has – here's my issue here. Drinkwater earlier this year was charged with drinking and driving after crashing his car in Greater Manchester while under contract at Chelsea. So, like, at a certain point, someone close to him has to kind of take him by the arm and just be like, enough.
You gotta stop.
Enough. Like, trouble is following you. You are still, you know, I know your career has hit a bit of a rough patch. You're not getting regular games for Chelsea, but you kind of have a new lease on life or new lease on your career at Burnley. Like, you can, you know, get regular playing time again, maybe get back on England's radar. Who knows? But don't let this undermine your career and your livelihood. And right now it is. And he's in kind of in shambles right now. And who knows when we'll see him again playing for Burnley or anyone. So, yeah, just bad situation for those who jumped him, bad situation for him finding himself in these types of situations. Just
I had to think where he was and what club he was on loan at.
Yeah.
Caught offsides man of the match.
What you got?
Kosovo manager Bernard Shalande. Kosovo may have conceded 5 at St. Mary's tonight, but they did score 3 against England, and their all-action style of play has them sitting in third in their group, just a point behind the Czech Republic, who they defeated last weekend in Euro 2020 qualifying. There is a real chance they could make next summer's tournament. Their manager, Bernard Shalande, is almost as energetic as his team when he describes their tactics, or more their style of play.
It's a tactical pressing. In a crazy game, it's go, return, go, 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 go. It's not tactic. Perhaps it's not right, the right run. But it's only here. I want to win the ball. It's not only defend. It's preparation for a goal for us.
Now, I totally understand what he means.
Throw tactics out the window. This is just if you want to press the way that I want you to. This is just about your pure effort and desire to attack.
100%. Now it leaves massive holes which England played through, but it's got them where they are. And tonight was Kosovo's first defeat in 15 games.
Wow, they played a brilliant own goal right into their own net. It was a very well worked move.
Again, in the middle of my man of the match, you focus on the negative.
A nice pass right into the center, just tapped in gently. It was beautiful.
Well, that's
go, 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 go!
How you can't hear that and not think of
we are very close.
Go, 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 go!
Which means I instantly want him to get a Premier League job. They've cruised through the Nations League, so that means they're more than likely to be in a playoff for the Pan-European tournament in 2020. That's not bad, Andrew, for a team that really didn't exist a few years ago. And on the day of their first game, were still registering players for the country. 80% of their players were not born in Kosovo. They were the sons of refugees who fled the conflict there. So it's pretty amazing. Wow. By the way, that drop for go, 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 I think when we're going too long on a podcast, or when I'm getting
like this one
too flowery in my language, we're going to hit this.
Go, 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 go!
It sounds a little bit like shots, 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 shots.
Everybody!
Let's see, my man of the match, JJ, I went with Samuel Eto'o. He announced announced his retirement
Old man Eto'o.
He's an interesting one because he left Inter Milan back in 2011 when he was still 30 for Anji Makhachkala in the Russian Premier League.
Makhachkala.
His talent sometimes goes forgotten, but let me read you this from ESPN's Graham Hunter. Hunter says, now that Samuel Eto'o has retired from football, debate will rage about whether or not he was the greatest African footballer of all time. In short, he was, and by some margin. That's from Graham Hunter. Eto'o won 18 trophies. He won the treble in back-to-back years with different clubs, one with Barcelona and then one the year after with Inter Milan.
That, by the way, that is just
it's an amazing achievement.
Nuts.
Yeah. He scored 130 times for Barca in 199 games. He scored 53 times for Inter in 102 games. He was brilliant in key moments like this one, his goal against Manchester United in the Champions League final in just the ninth minute.
This is Iniesta, though. Oh, Eto'o's opened it up. Now, how about that for smash and grab? It's been all Manchester United. But after 9 minutes, Samuel Eto'o crowns the first real attack.
He was a brilliant club player, but obviously he was a brilliant international player as well. He walks away as Cameroon's all-time leading scorer, and he's the all-time leading goal scorer in the Africa Cup of Nations. I would direct everyone to Graham Hunter's article that I referenced because you learn more about the complexity of the man rather than just the talent of the player. Graham talks about it. He could be short-tempered. Mm. He could hold a grudge, as he did against a couple of his former clubs, both Real Madrid, where they gave him a chance, but then they barely played him, and he left Real Madrid, and then he held a grudge against them. But then in Barcelona, where he was a great player, but Pep Guardiola came in and wanted him out. But players, Iniesta and Xavi, Graham Hunter writes about, those two went to Pep and basically said, look, we know that he can be difficult, but trust us. There is a player in here that we need. And so Pep stuck with him, and it bore fruit as they went on and won the treble. And obviously, Eto'o was a huge part
of that. That's incredible.
Yeah. So it's a really interesting piece. You learn a lot in it about Samuel Eto'o, like I said, off the field. It's good stuff. But as we know, Eto'o, at 38 years old, calling it quits on his career, absolute legend. And one of the great strikers of this generation for sure.
Oh, first came across my radar playing for Cameroon against the Republic of Ireland in the World Cup in 2002. And you know what, Andrew? I'm not saying that there was players, we'll say, like El Hadj Diouf, who came out with big reputations, you know, African Player of the Year, and then joined, you know, Liverpool, and it didn't quite work out for them. But Eto'o was such a brilliant player. Such an unbelievable player. To think what he did at Barcelona and then went and did it at Inter Milan in a totally different system. Completely different system.
I feel weird almost bringing this up so deep into this podcast because we got to get out. But, I mean, I don't want to just gloss over what Graham wrote there. That not only is this the best African player of all time, but it's not close. Do you agree with that? I mean, to me, like, Drogba has to be in that conversation. George Weah, I guess you would have to say.
I don't think George Weah had a prolonged period at the top as Eto'o had.
Well, yes. I guess because Eto'o came up at, 16 or 17 years old. Now, the fact that he kind of got out of the mainstream at 30 when he went to Russia and cashed in, he was, for a period of time, the most expensive player in terms of what he was making in wages in the world. But then it all fell apart at that club, and he kind of had that weird, you know, went to Chelsea, went to Everton, bounced around to a bunch of clubs, was in Turkey. He was never really quite the player he was pre-30.
No, you've caught me on the hop here.
I know.
To
me, it's Drogba or him.
Currently, there are players who you could say down the line, you know, maybe Sadio Mane, maybe Mohamed Salah will be in that. But, like, look at add two things together. Look at the goals that he scored for Barcelona in a really great Barcelona team. Look at the trophies then. Like, just if you add in the achievement and the play together, there's nobody close. There really isn't.
I got to say, too, he was sensational in FIFA.
Was he really?
Oh, my God. He was... Oh, yeah. one of the best players in the game, easily. Super fast, incredible finisher.
Yeah.
I kind of like him in real
life.
Yeah. I live life through games.
I never realized that it was quite so bad between him and Pep.
Pep wanted him out. Well, I think he even said as much at his opening press conference. But yeah, Iniesta and Xavi convinced him to at least stick with him for a year, and it bore fruit, that's for sure. And then it did when he left for Inter.
What's your favorite Eto? Inter Eto or Barcelona Eto?
Barcelona. I mean, the Barcelona of, like, we've grown accustomed to thinking that Messi, Neymar, Suarez is like as good as it could really get for Barcelona attack. Don't forget the era of Messi, I think it was Messi, Henri, and Eto that combined for 100 goals one season.
Right.
Between the three of them. That's incredible. You know, there was also obviously Messi, Ronaldinho, Eto. So
for a briefer period. Yeah.
But yeah, he was at the center of some of the greatest attacks that we've ever seen in club football, at least in this generation. So there you go, man.
No, I'm sad that he's retiring.
Yeah. Wow. What a show. This was an awesome It feels like our talk about the U.S. and Uruguay was like another lifetime.
Hours ago. Oh, my God. This is a long pod, isn't it?
Yeah, it is. It's like, hey, I've adopted your mentality. Who cares?
Who cares?
It's fun.
People are digging into it. They're loving it.
That's right.
It's meaty goodness.
It sure is, man. Hey, this was fun. Everybody check us out at CO Soccer Pod on Twitter. Like we said tonight, we've got a video up on Instagram of JJ handing me a wonderful gift for my son, Luke. That's Caught Offside ESPN.
Caught Offside ESPN on Instagram. Get on the old iTunes. Send us a review. We are still taking applications for the 5 stars for 5 years.
That's right.
We need to keep doing that. We've got a new one, but I'm damned if I'll be able to find it.
Oh, no.
It's one where
if I'll be able to find it.
Well,
I know how this works.
It's one where I stormed off the field I gave myself a red card for storming off the field, refusing to shake hands with any of the players in a game that I played.
You know, another one I wanted to kind of search for while we're thinking of these, that I saw someone submitted a while ago that was funny. We just have to find it. When I accused your mother of forgetting to bless you in the day that you tore your ACL, is the wound still too fresh on that? Is that not
the fact you still repeat it?
Are we not joking about this?
No,
yet?
We're not. Oh. Actually, no, we can still do it. But
it's not funny to you.
I'm like Eto. I bear grudges.
Oh, really?
Yep.
Oh, that's sad. Well,
We will do that one. I remember. That's not that long ago, actually.
Okay, you look for that one. Hey, this was fun, man. To you, I say,
take you later, fun boy.
See ya.
Take care.
You've been listening to the Caught Offside Soccer Podcast.